tonight on Arena. Jade performs in studio. Peter Goralnik talks to us about his new biography of Colonel Tom Parker and its remakes and sequels galore as we look at new films. @51551 is our text number, and you can email us arena@rte.ie. Tonight, 22 years on, a revival of the Body Swap movie, Liam Neeson turns to comedy, and an intimate portrait of an Irish musician lost too soon to film. First, tonight, we have four big releases. Lindsay Lohan and Jamie Lee Curtis are back for a follow-up to their classic Body Swap comedy in Freakier Friday. Julia Garner and Josh Brolin star in a small-town tale of missing children in the horror movie Weapons, an intimate portrait of an Irish musician in the documentary Conor Walsh Selected Piano Works, and Liam Neeson skewers his own tough guy image in a reboot of the classic comedy The Naked Gun. Donald Clark and Serena Bellissimo join me now in studio. Freakier Friday, let's start with that. Sequel 22 years on, which is a terrible number to think of anyway, from the original Freaky Friday. Serena, I don't think anybody was waiting for this sequel to happen. It's been years since we've had a big budget kind of body swap comedy, though, isn't it? Is this worth it?
It is. And do you know what? Nobody was waiting for this to happen. But as soon as it was announced, we all went, actually, yes, we'd like to see this again. I'd like to see Lindsay Lohan and Jamie Lee Curtis come back to the big screen together as mother and daughter like we saw. I can't believe it's 22 years ago. This time, I mean, you know what you're getting when you're going into something like this. Although this time they try to be a bit more adventurous, because now there's four people that a body swap is happening with. Lindsay Lohan's character, Anna, is now a mum. She has a teenage daughter. She also is about to get a stepdaughter because she has a love interest. They're about to get married. But, of course, the marriage isn't going to go off without a hitch. All of a sudden, on a Friday, get that, there's some freaky turn of events and the four of them swap bodies.
Is that why the title is Freaky? I hadn't paid attention. Donald, part of the appeal of these body swap comedies is so many kids wish they were adults, so many adults wish they were kids, but obviously this is a very different proposition now that everybody involved is 20, 30
years
older.
Yeah, it's actually funny you're talking about a long time since the last version. I mean, I can remember Jodie Foster in 1976. That really is a long time ago. Yes, I mean, when I first heard about this, I mean, I was thinking of a sequel reuniting Lindsay Lohan and Jamie Lee Curtis. I kind of wondered how that would work, as there are a difference between living in a 30-something body and a 60-something body. I know. But they're not the same, or not possibly as comical, as the difference between living in a teenage body and living in a 40-something body, as in the last film. And so I thought, how would that work? And they obviously thought the same thing. So they've basically gone back to the original plan and had adults swapping with children. Two in this case, as Serena says. Now, the first point I would say is this may be due to the fact that I'm older and more confused generally in life. But I was constantly getting lost. Like, who are you? Who is Jamie Lee Curtis now? Oh, yeah, she's the potential daughter-in-law at this point in the film. Do I have that right?
No, Jamie Lee Curtis was the grandmother.
No, she's a grandmother, yes. But in the film, she swaps with the potential
stepdaughter.
Yes, potential stepdaughter.
Yes, which would be her step-granddaughter.
Not daughter-in-law, you're quite right. Stepdaughter.
It doesn't bode well that the two of you are still at a point having seen the film and still not a
I think Serena's got it. I think I'm the confused one here.
Step-granddaughter. Can I just say, this is for the fans. This is a bit of nostalgia. I think the reason why we're seeing so much nostalgia, like we're going to be talking about Naked Gun later on, is because I think we just feel the need of a great big hug right now. There is so much going on in the world that sometimes we just want to go back to what we know. We know what we're going to get from Freakier Friday. We know what we're going to get from The Naked Gun. There's a little bit of twists and turn thrown in. And you know what? For 90, almost, I think it's close to 2 hours, you just escape for a little bit. This, does it have its flaws? Yes, it does. But is it funny? Is Jamie Lee Curtis living her best life right now? Yep. You watch this and you're just like, out of everyone on screen, you're having a ball. She was having a ball, wasn't she?
But it's interesting. I mean, she talked to my colleague Tara last week about, and she was pointing out that when she goes around, the film that people want to talk to her most about now is not Halloween. you know, it's not True Lies, it's Freaky Friday. Yeah. I mean, that remake had that degree of purchase with a certain generation. They've now grown up with it, and it's very important to them. And yeah, she is unrelenting. The amount of energy she puts into it really puts all the younger actors to shame. I mean, the younger actors are all kind of slightly laid back and kind of, you know, I don't know. Whereas she is, as she always has been for the last 40 years, absolutely on high dough at 11 all the way throughout it, which is very funny, I think. And I think what it's funniest about in terms of the swap is less about the differences between old people and young people as about the perceptions that young people have of old people.
Mm, so and vice versa.
Yeah. So it's quite a funny scene where they go into the pharmacist and... So whoever the young person is in Jamie Lee Curtis's body...
the step-granddaughter.
Thank you. Yes. Decides that...
This is more confusing for those of us who haven't
everything.
Seen the film.
She needs everything that old people need. Like, you know, she needs, like, incontinence pants and she needs, you know, glue for her dentures and, like, comes up with all this stuff. And, like, she's only 66, Jamie Lee Curtis. Give her a break. But that stuff I thought was actually quite funny. It is absolutely grand, and it's familiar, which, as you say, is something that people, I think, crave these days.
Is the remake thing, and we'll talk about Naked Gun later as well, a sign of that need for calm in people's lives, or maybe just some reassurance?
Well, it's a sign that the studio's panicking as well.
I mean, that was the question I was going to ask you.
Studios are enormously nervous, but we're living in an era where all the money is made by two or three enormous franchise hits. And we're in an era now where a number of those franchise hits are just not landing. I mean, and there are very few original films making any kind of serious money. I mean, the only two big ones this year, really, outside China, without complicating things, are Sinners and F1. And even F1 is essentially, you know, an arm of the Formula One industry.
I hate using the phrase, it's based on an original IP, just that kind of IP.
Yeah, but I mean, it's an extraordinary thing. So no wonder that people are getting more and more conservative with their choices in terms of big commercial films.
Okay, we're going to play a clip from this. Serena, before we listen to us, tell us a little bit about the love interest dimension. Let's complicate this even further in our own heads between the single mother, Anna, who's played by Lindsay Lohan, mm-hmm. and single father, Eric, who's played by Manny Jacinto. How does that work?
So he is over from London, and he's come over. He's a world-famous chef who's come to live in LA for a year. They meet, they fall in love, and they then decide that they're going to get married. But that's not the only spanner in the works. Of course, there's two teenage daughters who... You know, who has she chosen to go out with? Her teenage daughter's nemesis. Of course she has, because that's what happens in these things. So not only do we have that spanner thrown in the works, the other spanner is, well, one of the daughters is going to have to leave her hometown. So they're either going to have to go to live in London or they're going to stay in LA. So there's all of that as well. But I do love that we get to see Lindsay, and I know it's not her falling in love. I know she's acting, but I do love that we get to see some happiness for Lindsay Lohan on screen falling in love. I love with this film that we see just a return to form for Lindsay Lohan. I hope that this is her next chapter. We see Jamie Lee Curtis having a ball, and the two young leads, one of them you'll actually notice, Julia Butters, played the young girl. Remember Once Upon a Time in Hollywood?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
She was the young girl from that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So okay. They're all brilliant in this.
We're going to take that clip. It is Lindsay Lohan as Anna, Manny Jacinto as Eric, and ex-Mayo playing the school principal who's brought both parents in to discuss an incident between their respective daughters.
This is serious. Someone could have been injured.
I'm sure it was just an accident.
It seems to me a misunderstanding. Harper seems so lovely.
Oh, well, Lily, it seems so genuine and kind.
Wow. I certainly never had two parents come in here and be this attractive. I meant attentive.
Lily and I are definitely going to reflect on how to do better.
This is all Harper and I are going to think about.
We're very, very committed, especially as a single parent household.
Oh, us too. Oh. We're single parent.
Great.
I mean, I'm a single parent.
Yeah. Great.
Yeah,
yes.
You know what I mean.
Same. Me too.
Single.
Single parent. Guilty.
I'm single too. Oh my God, should we meet up?
Perhaps our daughters should get to know each other.
Maybe like Wednesdays after 6, get a little wine, talk about these badass kids.
That got a couple of chuckles out of me.
See? It's a bit of fun.
It's fine. It's fine.
It's not made for Donald's demographic.
Donald, maybe answer me this then. In terms of recent Lindsay Lohan, and she has had highs, lows, experiences in Ireland, falling in love, how does this rank alongside all of her recent Correct.
Well, she's always been very good. I mean, that she had a fortunate kind of, you know, personal difficulties in her career. But I never faulted her as an actress. And she's, you know, at her best, she's always been great and also terrific comic timing and the kind of assurance that. And I would say, I think people got a little bit too head up about Irish Wish last year, which was absolutely fine. And there was no real reason to ever have hysterics and write 1,200 word pieces about how it was an annihilating destruction of all that we treasure in Irish culture. But no, I think she's good in this film, and I think she usually is good. So, I mean, I'm not surprised in saying that.
And Serena, it seems like there's a rule in place, and I'm entirely behind this rule, by the way, that every third film or TV series these days has to have Jamie Lee Curtis in it. I'm entirely behind this. That's a good thing.
I think it's a great thing. And it's especially a great thing when she doesn't look bored. You know, you see sometimes these actors get really comfortable in their own skin and just go, I'm just doing this to make the money. Because she could have done that.
Robert De Niro.
Exactly. Like Meet the Fockers number four. Like what that.
Yeah.
You know. No. But no, I'm thrilled that she's in this, having a ball.
Let's do stars out of five. Serena?
I'm going to give this a 4 out of 5, but not necessarily for the cinema. You could wait to see this on streaming. I'm shocked that this got a cinematic release.
Okay, Donald?
I give it a 3, yes. I'm sure they thought about that. I'm sure at some stage whether it would just go to streaming. But I give it a confident 3. It does what it intends to do for a large audience.
Okay. Moving on to Weapons. Donald, you've been to see this. It is a highly anticipated horror movie given the director's previous film, Barbarian. Where are we in this film in Weapons? What's going on?
Yeah, there's a lot of pressure on Zach Cregger after Barbarian, which was a terrific horror film from a few years back. It is said there was a bidding war for this script, which often doesn't work out well. More often than not, that whenever something that has a bidding war around it comes to screen, it proves to be something of a disappointment. He intimated that there was something of Paul Thomas Anderson's Magnolia in it, which I think is a stretch.
That's a high bar to set.
It does tell its story through 4 or 5 different parallel narratives told by individual characters from this yarn. So there's that in that. But actually, this partly is a compliment and partly not a compliment. What it is the best ever Stephen King adaptation of, that is not actually an adaptation of a Stephen King story. It has all those rhythms. You have a smallish town community that is disturbed by some weird event. You then go amongst the lives of those people, and at the end it all ends with a mighty conflagration that explains it all in lucid terms. What happens here is, early on we learn that on one particular night, all but one of the children from a particular class, particularly elementary school class, leave their beds, leave their houses, and with their arms extended, walk towards an apparently annihilating horizon, never to be seen again. There's something of The Leftovers, that television series, in it as well. There's a slight hint of that about it as well. And then when we come to what counts as the present day in the film, their teacher, the class teacher, Julia Garner, is under a lot of pressure because people think she must be involved in some way because she was the one thing that connected these children together. The characterization, I think, is good. You've got good actors like Garner, Alden Ehrenreich, who plays her ex, who is a police officer. Benedict Wong is the headmaster. All very good. They make real characters of these personalities. The MVP, I would say, is Amy Madigan. I can't say too much about what she does, but I will say there's something of the psycho biddy genre here, which we got a few weeks ago with Bring Her Back, that Australian film, and she's absolutely in top form on this and really kind of steals the show. I do think that it asks questions it can't satisfactorily answer, which, to be honest, is something that often happens with the longer Stephen King novels as well. Nonetheless, it's a very impressively put together piece of work that stands a serious film.
Okay, I'm going to take a clip from it here. This is Julia Garner's character, and she's had the word witch painted on her car, and she's confronted then by a local father who's played by Josh Brolin.
Hey, I want to talk to you.
I don't think we have anything to say to each other.
Yeah, I think you have a lot to say.
You and every other person in this city, believe me, the message is loud and clear. I'm the problem. Got it.
You know what? I think that's the first honest thing I've heard you say. You are the problem.
What, you want to get in my face? You want to threaten me?
Nobody's threatening you right now.
You're barking up the wrong tree, okay?
You know what? This whole victim persona that you're taking...
And I suppose my question for you is this one that is solely for horror fans who, let's face it, are an enormous audience and films can do very well from these days? Or is there any comedy amidst this? Is there anything for anyone else?
Well, it's a go on about Stephen King. One of the things that kind of Stephen King did well, well, does well whenever he's really motoring, is that he creates human, ordinary human stories. The larger stories he writes are not just about whatever the threat is, and are not just concerned with how they deal with that threat. He creates people who have ordinary human problems that they're trying to deal with as this kind of weird supernatural force gathers around them. And that's certainly true in this case. Each of these characters feels reasonably rounded, and certainly you can engage with them even if you're not an aficionado of horror. Having said that, it does, I mean, you know, if you're wary of horror, it does end up with, like, you know, full-on, you know, bloodletting in the last 15 minutes. So it's only fair to point that out to people who perhaps are a bit queasy about those things. There's no question about that. It is full-on towards the end. But also then right at the end, I won't say anything about what happens. It's a terrific... I mean, I was hesitant about the last sort of 15 minutes until the very end, when it makes one big jump, which it almost ends up in, like, silent comedy, which I thought was terrific. And you walk out feeling satisfied, even if not everything in the denouement adds up.
I thought for the first time here you were going to jump straight to spoiler at the end, explain what had happened, and then just...
I know better than that after all these years. I know better than that.
Okay, stars out of five?
Four.
Okay, four out of five is good. The movie is Weapons. We will take a break and we will be back having a look at a documentary and at The Naked Gun after this. Welcome back to Arena. I want to turn to The Naked Gun, a film we didn't get to cover last week. Serena, tell us, how does this relate to the previous, and I'm going to say this phrase out loud, although I immediately feel slightly ill inside by saying it, Naked Gun cinematic universe?
Well, do you know what? It doesn't stray from what it's about, but while I say that, it still makes it its own. So Frank Drebin was the original head bumbling police cop in Police Squad. This is Frank Drebin Jr. now, played by Liam Neeson. There's a case that has to be solved, and if he doesn't solve it, lo and behold, what will happen? The Police Squad will close down. But it's not just about him. He then bumps into Beth, who's played by Pamela Anderson, and she's also invested in this murder case because it's her brother, and she wants to prove that it wasn't accidental. He really was murdered. So that's the simplicity of it all. I love that what this film does really well is it does do the hat tip to the original film. So you will see all of the original characters mentioned in hilarious ways, but then they also make it its own, their own. It's stupid. It's ridiculous. It's silly. But if you're in the mood for that, it's oh so fabulous.
I'd be disappointed if it was anything other than all
exactly.
of those things.
But you have to be in the mood, because if you're not in the mood for, like, sight gags and slapstick and just ridiculous, like a coffee cup that is just progressively getting bigger and bigger as the film goes on, if you're not in the mood for that, it could just feel like, oh, this is a really stupid film. But if you're in the mood for that, it can be like, it's a really stupid film and I love it.
Donald, Liam Neeson, I mean, he might not have been the most obvious choice for this role.
Well, I mean, yes and no. He's actually done good deadpan comedy before. He was very funny in Extras, was a long time ago, mind you, the Ricky Gervais series. And he was great as the RUC man in Derry Girls. Mm. And so he has a keen understanding of the absurdity of many of the roles that he has played, particularly in the last sort of 15 years when he's embraced all these revenge movies that he got propelled into after Taken. I mean, I would say on Neeson, I wasn't entirely convinced by Neeson in this film, because having said what I said, everybody else is kind of playing it straight deadpan. I'm getting a sense he's trying to almost make sense of the lines as he goes through them, which Leslie Nielsen never did, who was always kind of like, you know, utterly deadpan, utterly flat. He's not bad. I'm not saying he's bad at all, or if he kills it. But I think I was happier with what Pamela Anderson and Danny Houston were doing around him, who seemed to be making no effort to make sense of the lines. The issue I thought funny going in, and it's not an issue, but it's something I thought about, is that way back to 1982 was when the Police Squad series was. I'd forgotten it was all that long ago. I mean, that was a parody of a type of television, of a school of television show that was already slightly out of date.
Things like Streets of San Francisco.
Exactly, yeah. The Quinn Martin series of the 1970s, yeah. Like Streets of San Francisco, which had often had these other pompous titles and had separate parts, and each of which had a name.
Chapter the Fourth.
All that stuff. They're hilariously pompous. And you kind of think, well, that's, I mean, you may as well be parodying medieval mystery plays now. That's so long in the past. And in fact, one of the Zucker brothers did say, well, how is a remake going to work? Like, you have to be parodying something, and this stuff is parodying things that aren't made anymore, haven't been made for 40 years. Doesn't matter. Yep. Simply does not matter one iota. The thing is a joke delivery system, and I think the jokes are actually really good. I mean, I got the sense of the press screening I was at, people gradually coming round to say, I don't know, we need this. By the end, they were chortling and slapping their thighs at the accumulation of brilliantly dumb gags.
And let's be honest, if press critics are chortling by the end of a film like that, it's going to be fantastic. Let's take a clip from this. Liam Neeson as Frank Drebin Jr., investigating major sports stars, culminating in an encounter with an ice hockey player, Adam Fox, at a urinal.
It was 8:01 when I arrived at ESPN. The name's Drebin, police squad. I was investigating a mysterious wave of crimes happening throughout all of sports. I've got a few questions for you. These records indicate nearly 4,000 thefts in baseball last year.
You mean stolen bases? That's part of the job.
Part of the job. The case was starting to give me an itch, but not the fun kind. I was going to have to keep my eyes peeled.
And then what happened?
I stole the ball right from under her.
Did you say stealing? How do you sleep at night? This crime spree was bigger than I thought. Baseball? Basketball? What's next? Adam Fox. Keep your hands where I can see them. I hear you've been starting fights in public with thousands of witnesses.
It's all part of the game.
So you think this is a game, huh? Career criminals. How deep did this go? This guy didn't wash his hands. Time to make some arrests.
Sold. Really briefly, Serena, before we ask you for your stars, and I say very briefly because it's everywhere on the internet and it's all I see right now, the chemistry / relationship / immense marketing campaign between Liam Neeson and Pamela Anderson.
Yeah, their chemistry is off the charts. Is it a marketing campaign? Is it real life? I don't know. We are all so invested. I love the two of them. I have
we
no doubt.
We all want it to be real, don't we?
We do. Yes. But I have no doubt we will see a sequel to this. If it makes the big bucks, we will get a sequel. I hope they don't do what happened in the 80s and 90s, though, like with all the body swap films, all of this stuff. We don't want too many, so then it kills it.
Okay, stars from both of you?
I'm going to give this a 4, and an extra star was for Liam Neeson singing over the credits. Fabulous.
3.5, I think, that it works. It just works like gangbusters.
85 minutes long.
Yeah.
So you got to give an extra star for that.
I think it's about the same length as the first one, I think, all those years back.
Okay, let's take a look at our final film. It is the documentary Connor Walsh, Selected Piano Works. Donald, remind us about Connor Walsh and who he was.
Yeah, a very interesting documentary on Connor Walsh, who was a pianist and composer from Swinford County Mayo, who sadly died very young of a heart attack in 2016. And Keith Walsh, no relation, I believe, has gone back and made a documentary culled from old interviews of his and woven those in with visual representations, visual commentaries on on Connor Walsh's pieces. It's an odd piece, and Walsh, when interviewed, there's a great deal about minimalism in this documentary. We're dealing with a minimalist composer. The images are stark and minimalist, and he is quite minimalist in his delivery and in his description of his working practices, Walsh himself, which could be a problem. Because to a certain extent, you go to a documentary and want to have the working practice explained to you. And he was kind of reluctant to do that, I think. But nonetheless, you get a sense of the personality, which is important. You could almost call them videos. The accompaniments to the music are actually very effective and make very good use of the rhythms within those pieces in the way in which they kind of reflect them with images of nature, other composed images, which I think don't offer an interpretation of the music, but offer a satisfactory accompaniment.
Okay, we'll take a clip from it. It's Connor Walsh's music overlaid with a phone interview that he did with David Desmond for Totally Dublin.
I grew up in Mayo. I started to write tunes as a teenager with guitar and vocals. I did this all through my teens. And I was a teenager in the 90s, so I was from the Nirvana era, and I guess
was the piano something that you took up at a later stage?
Right, yeah. So the piano was like something that was that I was made to do when I was in my teens, and sure, I couldn't stand it doing grades and stuff like that. So I did a couple of early grades, and then once I had a sniff of an opportunity, I quit and focused on the guitar. But it was around that time, around that period in the 90s, where the ultimate thing was to play guitar and sing. It probably still is to a degree.
Serena, was this in some ways almost like an extended music video rather than a documentary?
Yeah, it feels like a visual album, but it also, I was really interested in how it was made, because his music was all about being abstract, and this film is abstract. It's not telling you how to feel about Connor or his music. It's leaving it up to you. I think this is a beautiful tribute for his family and fans.
Yeah, Donald, Connor's is the only voice that features here. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a bold choice.
It is, but it's not a long film. I mean, it's a relatively short film, so I don't think that proves overpowering. And it is appropriate, given, as I go back to my original point, how stark and minimalist the entire operation is, that having just one voice kind of chimes with that aesthetically, so that makes sense. And I think people who are unfamiliar will find this a very worthwhile introduction. People who are familiar will, I think, also be equally happy to see that the artists that they like represented in a very tasteful and appropriate fashion.
Okay, for both of you, stars out of 5?
I'll give it a 3.
I'll give it a 4, I think. Just, you know, I think it does what it sets out to do very effectively.
Okay. My thanks to Donald Clark and to Serena Bellissimo. Freakier Friday and Weapons are on general release from Friday. Connor Walsh's Selected Piano Works is in selected cinemas, and Naked Gun is in cinemas nationwide already. The National Concert Hall's Landmarks series is a celebration of the music of a range of artists through the milestone albums of their careers. Next month, the well-known indie and electronic artist Jape will perform in that series. Jape began as the solo project of Richie Egan, formerly of Redneck Manifesto, and he joins me in studio this evening. Thanks a million for coming in, Richie.
Hi, Rick. How's it going?
You're going to play something for us before we talk about all of this. What are you going to start with?
This is a song called At the Heart of All This Strangeness, and this is from the second album that will be showcased on the night, called Ritual. It's a worthless dream to believe in. Let's take another stroll where the kids are getting out of their minds. We'll walk in side by side, pulsating with the stars in the sky. At the heart of all of this strangeness, you are changing. At the heart of all of this strangeness, you are changing. You're not a wave, you're part of an ocean. And you'll break without a fuss or any commotion. When you're older and holding on to some things that have already gone, you're making plans for tomorrow. Well, tomorrow is no yesterday. At the heart of all of this strangeness, changing. Take a look at the state of all the scenery. There is nothing but hate in every diction, every again. It's a petrified forest we are living in.
Just gorgeous. That's Richie Egan, Jape here on Arena. Sorry, you were saying to me, Red Deck Manifesto they're still together.
Yeah,
and you're still part of them, and you're about to put something new out.
We're putting a 10-inch out called Grushy on 10 Spot Records around the start of September. So we have gigs in Galway, Cork, Limerick, and Dublin just before the National Concert Hall gig. So it's going to be a busy couple of weeks.
It's important to get all the plugs in, yeah. I find.
Just before we start, can I just send my sincere condolences to Sean Rock's family and all the friends and staff here, because it was such a shock, and he was such an amazing man. And all the musicians I've spoken to over the week have just been saying, you know, how amazing he was. So just wanted to say that before we start our chat.
You can, of course, and thank you so much. Richie, you're these days to be found, and certainly for the last few years, in Sweden. Your life professionally and personally is all there. Why so?
Well, I've got my kids are actually Swedish kids, and wife are in Dublin at the moment. So we live over there now. So I've been there 12 years, and I've got a studio over there as well. So I just kind of chip away, like live a bit of a monk's mode, and just make music on a day-to-day basis there. Yet
we were talking about this just a little bit earlier before all this. So you live in Malmo. What's that like as a city for music and for
it's
culture?
It's become much better culturally in the last while, because a lot of like Copenhagen's cultural life is sort of bleeding in there because of the fact that the Copenhagen currency is so strong, the Danish currency is so strong. So a lot of Danish people will come to Malmo for their leisure time.
Tell me about, I want to scroll back quite a lot here. So from an early age, you were part of bands fairly early on, and you were experimenting with sound. Why was that? Where did that come from for you?
Well, I started in punk bands, you know. I was started off listening to Nirvana, kind of blew my mind when I was about 14, as they did many people's, and then just got into like the DIY scene, you know. So all the bands like Fugazi and a lot of American punk, and realised that you don't have to have a massive studio to make good music. You can just have a four track at home, you know. So I just started experimenting, and then out of that just started making my own music as well as being in punk bands. So I always loved Simon and Garfunkel as well, you know, and that kind of melodic stuff. So
yeah, see, those influences I can hear a little bit in my own head, and having listened to your music over the years, and God, for the last whatever 23, 24 years now, I wouldn't have put Fugazi as being an influence.
Yeah, big time, man. I mean, punk is a state of mind, really, isn't it? Like, yeah. You know, it doesn't really matter what you sound like if you have the mindset of, like, you know, creation is your thing.
I want you to tell me a little bit about it as well, because I think it's genuinely lovely about your work composing music for animated shows for kids on TV, because how does that come about?
Yeah, well, it actually started a few years ago, where a guy called Connor Finnegan made a video for Jape, and he was working on a show called Becca's Bunch, which was produced by a Dublin studio called Jam for Nickelodeon. So I started making songs for that show. That was the first one. And I made like 52 songs for that show, and I just really took to it, you know. It's amazing to make really short songs about, like, riding on a bicycle, for example, for children, you know. And my kids were kind of young at the time, so they're like a great test audience. And yeah, so I've done a bit of that. I'm doing a bit of it now, like underscore stuff. I just really like, for some reason, I really like to make music for cartoons as well as everything else. So
I saw an interview, and I think it's a while back now, but you said that you'd created music primarily to boost your mental health, but that there came a turning point where that wasn't the case anymore.
Yeah, I guess so, yeah. I mean, music is so important to me, but maybe I realised that it should be part of a holistic whole rather than just the one thing that I focus on in sort of a bullheaded manner, you might say. So I kind of started to look at other areas of my life where I could maybe chill out a bit, you know. Mm.
Do you have some sort of a perspective of the Irish music scene from living elsewhere? So living in Sweden, looking back here, does that give you a kind of perspective about it? What sort of thoughts do you have on that?
I mean, there's so many great... like somebody was asking me about the time. Like there's always been so many amazing Irish artists if you scratch the surface, you know. I started off true punk listening to bands like the Mexican Pets and Tension and Pet Lam and all back in the day. And there was no internet then. So, I mean, the international audience couldn't find those artists as readily as they can today. And now you've got amazing acts who are doing really well. And people on TikTok or Instagram can see these Irish artists, and it's amazing. But it's like it's always been quality, you know. I know more people can find it.
I want to talk about the gigs. You're doing two albums in their entirety at the National Concert Hall. It's part of their Landmarks series next month. Tell us about the two albums that you've chosen to do and why them.
Well, the first album was called The Monkeys in the Zoo Have More Fun Than Me. And that was, again, when I started making songs, it just sort of fell into the idea of maybe you should do an album. So I did that album and I had Floating on it. And then that song, Floating, did really well for me. And it sort of like opened up a career. So that album is quite introspective album. And then that led on to Ritual, which is the album after that, that was is much more sort of like extrovert of an album, more electronic sort of stuff. And it's been interesting to go. I was one of those people who said I'd never do one of those look back things, but when they asked me to do it, I went and listened to the albums, and some of it still stands up, you know. And it's interesting to hear it from the point of view of 20 years later and sort of going, yeah, like, I mean, you know, I think songwriting is about trying to find truth, and I think there are some songs that do have a bit of truth in them from then. They're not all amazing. There's a couple of clunkers, but most of them are actually pretty decent, you know. So it's been interesting, and it's really nice to have a band, to get a good band together and rework the tunes. And yeah, it's cool, you know. It's going to be a nice vibe.
I'm conscious that you and I probably sat in a studio very different to this one, much smaller, much darker, when I was on Nighttime 2FM in 2004, and probably did something quite similar to this, talked about the music and about the band, and that is 21 years ago, which is just...
I was probably drunk then as well.
That's... I can't comment to that. It's been a long time ago, and the statute of limitations is done on it.
Yeah.
You're going to play something... else for us, what is it going
to
be?
Yeah, well, I'm going to, just to prove that I'm not a one-hit wonder, I'm going to do a version of Floating now, you know.
I would have been disappointed if you hadn't. I was looking forward to that.
I used to think, you know, you shouldn't do, there was a time when I wouldn't do it live and stuff, but that was a bad idea. So here we go, Floating, okay?
First pill when the music was shit, I said fuck dancing all night, but then that's just what we did. It felt like floating, it felt like floating. Your body was warm when I lay by your side, I said I'm glad I have found you, and I'm glad we're alive. It feels like floating, it feels like floating. We lay by a river, we looked at the stars, I said how tiny we are, girl, how tiny we are. It feels like floating, feels like floating. It feels like floating. A lifetime is short and death is so long, I don't believe in no heaven, but I hope that I'm wrong. I hope we're floating, hope we're floating. There's much in this world I don't understand, you know, it just makes much more sense when my hand's in your hand. It feels like floating, feels like floating, it feels like floating.
Cool.
That is a joy. That's fantastic. Still sounds as good as it did 21 years ago.
Got legs.
Richie Egan of Jape, thanks for joining us on Arena.
Thanks so much for having us in.
Really appreciate it. Jape will perform their albums The Monkeys in the Zoo Have More Fun Than Me and Ritual at the National Concert Hall as part of the Landmarks series on Sunday, September 14th. For more information, you can go to nch.ie. Cool. And you're listening to Arena. Last Train to Memphis and Careless Love are widely considered the definitive two-volume biography of Elvis Presley. The author of those books, Peter Goralnik, has also written biographies of Sam Cooke, Robert Johnson and Sam Phillips and has been described as a national resource for his work on America's intertwined black and white musical traditions. Peter's latest book, The Colonel and the King, is a biography of Colonel Tom Parker, the manager who oversaw Elvis's meteoric rise and Promethean fall. And Peter Goralnik joins us now. Peter, Elvis fans who only know of Colonel Tom Parker by reputation or maybe through the performance in the recent Elvis biopic of Tom Hanks might believe that the Colonel was a grasping money man who destroyed the purity of Elvis's rock and roll. Was that your experience of Colonel Tom Parker?
No, not at all. But we've got to encourage them to read the book. I mean, I understand it's not easy to overcome these ingrained prejudices. So, you know, it's like, but no, I think that with Colonel Parker, which is an entirely separate biography, Sam Phillips as Colonel Parker, and he played such a great role in Elvis's career, particularly at the beginning. But every single thing that he did, and I know this is going to be hard for some people to believe, but it's documented in the book, and I hope I explain it well, was aimed at furthering Elvis's artistic ambitions. One of the early chapters in which Elvis occurs in the Elvis section. I mean, before he met Elvis, his achievements are astonishing. And if the story ended before he ever met Elvis, it would still be a fascinating biography. But once he met Elvis, one of the early chapters is called Defending Elvis. And he defended Elvis against the attempts on the part of every single entity. This is at the start of Elvis's career when he signed with RCA, the record company, the movie companies, the agency, William Morris, and television were all vying to compress Elvis, to homogenize Elvis, to present an Elvis who would have been entirely different from the Elvis who exploded on the world. And Colonel's entire thrust that's borne out in his extensive correspondence, which is the basis for the biography, is to let Elvis be himself. He responds again and again, my artist knows his business, my artist knows what he wants to do, I will do nothing to further your ends. And when, for example, Steve Scholes and Bill Bullock, the two people essentially in charge of Elvis's career at RCA, when Bill Bullock wrote and said, you're going against what the agreement that I thought we had. I thought we were all agreed that we were trying to create a pop artist and you're not doing anything of the sort. And he wrote back and said essentially, I really appreciate your input. I'm going to do exactly what my artist wants to do, and that's to continue on the same course.
Yeah, I want to maybe just scroll back a couple of steps, because in the introduction to the book, you talk about the research you did and about the writing and about how it challenged your preconceptions. Maybe tell me a little bit more about those preconceptions and why do you think it is that the Colonel got such bad press, even to this day, amongst Elvis fans?
Well, as to why he got bad press, you'd have to ask the press. I mean, there's a lot of bad press. A lot of people get bad press. And as Colonel said, when one of his great friends at William Morris said, everybody at the office is upset by Elvis's appearance on the second Milton Berle. It caused a national furor. And Colonel wrote back and said, they'll get over it. They'll go on to the next scandal. He said, look at what happened with Robert Mitchum, who'd been busted a few years before, you know, for smoking pot. And as he said, they got over it, and they got over with Elvis. But why the first part of your question I seem to have misplaced.
Yeah, it's just about those preconceptions that you brought yourself to the project, right, okay. And how they changed.
I think fundamentally, I mean, I felt, I did know a lot about Colonel. I wasn't writing about him in the dark when I wrote about him in Careless Love in particular. And when I wrote a portrait of him and my relationship with him, and I'm not trying to elevate that to the biggest thing in the world, but I knew him for about 10 years and we had a very active correspondence and I met him on a number of occasions and interviewed him. And we had a congenial exchange to the extent that an exchange can be called congenial when every time I tried to draw him out, he just completely circumvented me. He anticipated my every move and completely ended it. And then offered help. I mean, after saying, I'm sorry, I can't help you, but then he would offer help. But the preconceptions I had, essentially, you can look, and I'm not trying to disown what I wrote before. It was absolutely true to my understanding. But I used Colonel really as the, I don't want to say I used him. That sounds very, I don't know what, using. But in Careless Love, I used him really for the narrative thrust of the story. And he was the sort of the Falstaffian figure who carried the narrative. And to some extent, as I look back on it, I saw him as a character then. It was a fairly full dimension character, but it was somebody, it was like a lovable rapscallion. It was somebody who always rose above the fray, somebody who, as in my correspondence, was able to outwit anyone who was trying to pin him down in any way. And that's the way I described him in the portrait that I drew in Looking to Get Lost. And again, it's true to my experience. But as I wrote this book over a period of 5 or 6 years, and as I immersed myself further and further, I saw a much deeper portrait emerged, character or an individual with far greater highs and far greater lows. I saw somebody of much greater vulnerability and sensitivity, somebody who had clearly suffered some kind of trauma that never went away in his early years in Holland, which led to his estrangement from family and country for the rest of his life. But I also saw someone of such wit, of such cleverness, of such intellectual heft, someone who was such a great writer in the manner in which he expressed himself. And in these letters are somewhat challenging. It wouldn't surprise me if the casual reader said, okay, I've read enough when they get done with the biography, because Colonel's letters are a challenge. His language is sometimes invented. His sentences almost always run together. Punctuation is very peculiar, and the syntax is almost non-existent. And I tried to, in several instances, I tried at least to provide periods and end stops. But it's an astonishing form of self-expression. It's almost a stream of consciousness in the way that On the Road is a stream of consciousness. And it just pours out of him. And the eloquence and the wit with which this fifth grade dropout in Holland for him, could express himself and could seek the ends which would benefit his artist, I thought were extraordinary. And that changed my thinking and my orientation.
I want to take a very, very brief clip of some Elvis, if we can. Maybe we'll play a little bit of Mystery Train.
Mm-hmm.
No, you're not listening to RTE Lyric FM. You are listening to RTE Radio 1 with Mystery Train. But Elvis, there. I'm talking to Peter Goralnik about his new book about Colonel Tom Parker. I'm interested in, and you mentioned it in the book, that there was only once that he pressured Elvis into recording a particular song, and that was Are You Lonesome Tonight?
That's right. But I should point out, I mean, with Mystery Train, which is such a miraculous song, and Sam Phillips always felt it was not only Elvis's greatest achievement in the studio, but perhaps one of the greatest achievements by anyone he ever recorded in the studio, and its freeness and spontaneity. And in light of your question, I should point out that if Colonel had been managing him then, he would have had absolutely nothing to do with Mystery Train, because he virtually never entered the studio, and he may have entered when it was recorded. He sought to have no influence whatsoever. The one song that he ever asked Elvis, because he believed totally in Elvis, he believed in that Elvis was the greatest artist he had ever encountered. And that doesn't mean he believed in rock and roll. He believed in Elvis, and he believed that there was a future. Elvis could evolve into a form of expression which was utterly unique, and that he, Colonel Parker, was the person who could carry him there. But as far as Are You Lonesome Tonight went, it was his wife Marie's favorite song. And he always said that she had heard it by Gene Austin, the first of the four superstars that Colonel managed. The only other real one was Eddie Arnold, whose Colonel brought to heights parallel to Elvis's before he ever met Elvis. But he felt that this was something that Elvis could really feel, a song that, and with which he could reach the new audience whom Elvis wanted to reach. As Elvis frequently said, his fans were growing up. They were growing older. They weren't growing old, but they were growing older. And you can hear in the repertoire that he chooses after he gets back from the Army, and he chooses it. And his recordings in 60, 61, 62, 63 are absolutely extraordinary, probably some of the greatest work he ever did. But they're different. They're not a rejection of what he did before, but they're entirely different. Anyway, Elvis gave Colonel to understand, and Colonel told me, and I'm sure he told many people if he told me, that Elvis only recorded the song as a favor to him, and it turned out to be a big success. The funny thing is that Elvis had been rehearsing the song, playing the song for the two years or the year and a half that he was in Germany, and singing it with Red West and Charlie Hodgson, singing it with great feeling. So Are You Lonesome Tonight definitely represents the only time Colonel asked Elvis to record a song, but it also may represent the only time that Elvis ever put over a joke on Colonel, and Colonel never learned the difference. So
it's been lovely talking to you tonight. My thanks, Peter Goralnik. The Colonel and the King, Tom Parker, Elvis Presley, and the Partnership That Rocked the World is published by Little Brown. That's it from Arena Tonight, produced by Reg Luby. Our research is by A.B. Philbin Bowman. The broadcast coordinator tonight was Ollie Hamilton. Sound supervision by Paul Murnock. I'm Rick O'Shea, and I will talk to you again tomorrow at 6:30.